You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, October 28th, 2017, and we are live from SciCon. This is your host, Stephen Novella, and joining me this week are Bob Novella.
It's not working. Hey, everybody. I had a really creepy laugh. It's not working.
Too bad. Kara St. Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, Steve.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And all the way from, well, not Australia, but Minnesota now, right? Dr. Rachy.
Hi.
You're originally from Australia.
Yes, and I now live in Wyoming, and I'm a cowboy now.
So Wyoming, right.
Wyoming, yeah. Wyoming. It's my new thing now. I just ride horses every day.
So you're an American now.
Basically, I pay taxes, so I guess I am an American now.
That's right.
Social Security.
Did you maintain dual citizenship?
No, I don't have citizenship.
You're not a citizen.
I'm not a citizen, no. I have to live here for 4 years. I'm an illegal, not illegal, a legal alien. Yeah. I have a visa.
It's very good. Right.
People say that to me. They say, oh, are you allowed to be here? Or are you like, not allowed? I'm allowed to be here, people. I have a visa. Okay, so it's fine.
Is it a work visa?
Yeah, it's a work visa.
Right. We're going to be talking more about, you know, the difference between skeptical activism in Australia and the U.S., because now you've sort of been on both sides.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a minute. Yeah. But actually, this is right in this hotel where we are right now, the picture that I'm showing you. And that, of course, is Richard Saunders, another Australian skeptic. So we were here a couple of days ago. We were here on Thursday, and Bob, Richard, and I were walking around. And, of course, we walked by this Pure Life booth where they're selling all sorts of interesting items, including these magnetic bands, you know, that you essentially, the ones you can get for just $5 at the SGU booth. They're basically, you know, rubber, plastic, and, you know, plastic holograms, like the power balance. And these things, there are so many of these things have been out. They usually sell for like $60 to $70 or $80 for literally a $1, you know, piece of plastic, with all sorts of claims. You know, we couldn't just walk by. We had to step up. But we didn't want to be the jerk skeptics, right? And we figured, oh, this poor woman, she's going to for quite the weekend, you know, with the skeptic conference. So we engaged with her, you know, and she was very nice. She asked us, she said, well, do you know how they work? And I did say, well, yeah, they don't work. But that was the snarkiest I got. She started to launch into some of the boilerplate, you know, and she said, well, it's just, you know, she said, well, you know, this is just to make people feel better. But, you know, if you could see sort of right in the middle in the background, actually behind the woman in the middle, there's a list of things that it treats, and it includes real medical conditions.
Like
migraines is on the list, you know, which of course I took notice
of. That's subjective.
No, migraines are a real physiological condition.
No, I know, but you could actually, you know, you could have like a headache and put it on and your head.
Yeah, but you're actually not allowed to name diseases. That's like you breaking the FDA rules when you do that. You could say it makes you feel better, but if you say it treats migraines, if you name a disease by name, you're actually breaking the law.
Okay.
But anyway, it reduces inflammation. You know, that's a very dubious claim. So real physiological medical claims. And we said, you know, so you're making claims here. These are medical claims. And we gave the quickie background on, you know, the applied kinesiology, how they test the things. And, you know, she was trying to be nice, but I could also tell, I don't think she was a true believer. I think she had a very superficial understanding of the product based upon the company's, you know, pamphlet, whatever. And that was it. She didn't care. You know what I mean? But anyway, we planted a seed. You never know. You know, we basically let her know, hey, listen, you know, these things don't work, and this is how people think. If there's a placebo effect, that's still good, right? It's like, no, not really. That's just deception.
If anybody's here in 3 months, let us know if she's still working there.
I'm kind of curious. So Richard didn't freak out.
No. Because, you know, Richard's produced videos debunking these bans.
Yeah.
So and he was telling me that, like, in these situations, people expect him to go up there, like, fire and brimstone, like, shut them down, you know. But what are you going to do? I mean, obviously, we're not going to be able to do that. But all we just politely explained our perspective and, you know.
Right here in the casino.
Right here in the casino, All right, let's get started with our usual content. Kara, what is the word for this week?
So we thought it would be fun to go with the word epistemology. I think it's a word that is often encountered when we are reading skeptical literature, when we're reading scientific literature, but definitely philosophical, psychological literature. And it's a word that is long and confusing sounding. So it's good.
But it has piss in the middle.
If it has piss in the middle, which is a bit exciting. And I do think it's one of those words that many people probably gloss over when they come across it. And it's not so easy to just use context clues with this one to fill in what it means. So defining it, you know, the two standard bearers that I often use on the show are Merriam-Webster and Oxford. I'll look at other sources as well, but really Merriam-Webster is kind of like the American Standard Dictionary and Oxford is the British Standard Dictionary. And they both have similar similar definitions, which have to do with the nature of knowledge and specifically with the limits, validity, methods, and scope of knowledge and the distinction between justified belief and opinion. So from a philosophical standpoint...
But Kara, I have to interrupt you. How do we really know what a word actually means?
Did that just come to you? So yeah, from, I mean, a true, pure kind of philosophical definition of the word epistemology really has to do with the study of how we know what we know. Like, that's really what we're talking about. And as I've been back in school this semester studying clinical psychology, I noticed that this word gets thrown around a lot. And there are a lot of psychologists who almost scoff at the idea of the medical model. And they scoff at the idea that somehow evidence-based knowing is the only epistemology available to us. So that's, I guess, some fun arguments there with my peers and my professors. So the etymology of this word is a really good one. I love it when I can point to exactly who first came up with the word. So it was James Ferrier in 1856. He was a Scottish philosopher. And when you break down the Greek roots of the word, so you can look at it right there, epi, which is a prefix, which actually... I think just recently on the show we did epicenter, right? So we already talked about that prefix. It means over. Above. And sta, actually, sta, and then mology is the study of something, but sta is to stand, make, or meet, or be firm. So the literal translation early on was overstand, which ultimately morphed into understand, which is really strange because there's not really much good literature on how we went from thinking of things as thinking of them over things and then thinking of them as being under things.
Oh, I was thinking more of like when you overstand something, you really get it.
No, it's really that the idea of understanding first was developed as an overstanding. Yeah. Which makes a little bit more sense to be over top something.
Did you look at the word understand and its etymology, how it relates to that? Is that the word understand is older than epistemology, right?
But I think that the original roots of those directions actually go back to an over development.
I interpreted the overstand, you know, in epistemology as it sort of sits above knowledge.
That's kind of what
Jay
said.
Hierarchically,
no, not at all.
Oh, you didn't.
No. It's like a meta kind of knowledge, right? It's knowledge about knowledge, so it's above knowledge.
But the Greek roots are even older than the word understand.
Yeah.
And so this idea of overstanding, I think that it was a change in how, because we've talked about this a lot on the show, about how our language has so much of a kind of proximal spatial component to it.
Embodied cognition,
exactly. And I think this is one of those things where overstanding and understanding at the root really are the same thing.
I overstand.
Yeah, there you go. All right. And then, of course, the scientific study of the roots and paths of knowledge. Ooh, wow, that got loud. Which is different than the philosophic understanding, but they're similar, is actually called epistemics. And that didn't come about until 1969.
It's not as old as I thought it would be. Even the, you know, 1850, what would you say, 18?
I know, yeah.
I thought it would be a much older word than that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think earlier philosophers did sort of ruminate on the nature of knowledge, but they didn't actually have a name for the field.
A word for the field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they crafted the word, right? So they pieced it together to make an aggregate meaning out of it.
I like it when that happens. When you can actually point to the person who first coined a term and they sat down and they thought about the Greek and Latin roots and they came up with a word that, etymologically speaking, makes sense instead of just pulling something out of their ass.
So do you think that still happens today? Like, I don't think the phrase like bling bling had.
But I wouldn't call bling bling a scientific.
Yeah, I don't think anyone deliberately constructed.
Oh, but
that.
Scientists do it a lot. But they also are really good at naming things in a kind of a tongue in cheek way. And I'm always really excited when I see that, like references to Star Wars or Harry Potter or things like that. You know, in scientific.
Or quarks.
Quark. That's a good one.
Three quarks from Musty Mark.
And you know, epistemology is one of those things that I think skeptics need to know. And you know, there's been a little bit of discussion within skepticism about the relationship between science and philosophy, and in fact, even the need for philosophy in science. And that, of course, you know, is epistemology, is the philosophy of how we know stuff.
There are people who think we don't need to study philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
what? I hope none of you are in this room.
Yeah.
So, what?
There were some pretty heavy hitters in
like
the science.
Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
Well, we don't but it's kind of like he's not really defining philosophy.
That's the point.
Yeah, it's like he uses philosophy.
You're
all
doing
the time.
Philosophy.
Yeah,
you don't
exactly.
You just don't realize it. But that's the worst thing you want to do. You don't want to, it's like doing science but not realize you're doing science.
Yeah, and also if you have a PhD, you have a doctorate of philosophy. Yeah. That is your degree, right? Like you should probably have studied at least some foundational.
No, I agree. And I think that's a legitimate criticism, I think, of science education is that we need to teach the philosophy of science as
absolutely.
Just part and parcel of it, right?
Yeah.
that different in Australia? I mean, do you think that there's more philosophy or less philosophy in Australia? Is that a cultural difference?
In the down over, what do they think?
No, there is not. The philosophy of science is not taught in undergraduate degrees in Australia at all.
Yeah.
In fact, it's considered a soft science, so people don't treat it as a proper thing.
Yeah. It's a problem.
It is a problem.
It absolutely is a problem,
I was lucky enough in my undergrad I was a psychology major, but I was a philosophy minor, and we actually had really interesting courses. I took a lot of religion courses for my minor, but I also took a philosophy of natural science course and a philosophy of psychology and the mind course. And I think that those influenced my graduate study almost more than the courses that I took in my major. Mm-hmm. They were really, really informative.
Yeah.
So now I'm hearing like under and over too much.
I know.
You're undergrad, not like you're overgrad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to pop up throughout the show. Sorry, guys.
Whenever we do the word thing, I'm always like, for a couple of days after we do the show,
you hear it all the time.
I'm hearing like,
there's a name for that phenomenon, like when you hear something that you see it everywhere.
Oh yeah, like in the movie Pie.
Like an earworm or something.
No, but there's a definite. Yeah.
So I got a message on Twitter recently from somebody who said, new record, the word of the week last week, and this is when we did Epicenter, appeared in my PhD thesis 116 times.
Good word.
It's great.
What was his PhD thesis on? Earthquakes?
Earthquakes, probably, yeah.
Okay, so as we're recording this, we're a few days before Halloween, and one of our favorite holidays. We love Halloween, but one of the annoying things about Halloween is that every cracky ass journalistic, other than Bob, besides Bob's fascination with all things Halloween, he wanted to do an all Halloween episode. By the way, like just beginning to end.
Yeah, right? Come on.
Yeah. Don't encourage him.
Too late.
So anyway, every media outlet, not just the bad media outlets, they have to do their fluff Halloween haunted ghost whatever story, and it's horrible, and they know it's horrible, but they got to do it. So this was just the one that hit my radar this time. Asking this simple question out loud could boost your chances of speaking to the dead, say experts.
Well, can't hurt your chances, can
it? Right. It's not going to reduce your chances.
Right.
That's correct. I agree with that.
What is their expertise?
Yeah, their expertise is in this. It's in ghost hunting.
It's in speaking to the
dead. It's in being gullible about ghosts. That's their expertise.
They are experts at speaking to the dead, which means they are just as good at it as I am.
So you have a degree in baloney.
Yeah, exactly. They're just as good at what they do as everyone else.
Anyone can speak to the dead. It's whether they respond, right?
Yeah. Exactly. They're saying that your chance of getting a response, they could improve your chance.
What's the question?
What do you think?
Are you dead?
it's just so like pop childish psychology kind of stuff. It's like, don't ask them, is anyone there? You should ask them,
what do you want?
What's your name? Because then you're assuming that they're there, and they're more likely to then respond to you.
And that does make sense, because in D&D, if you know the name of a demon, say, you can control it.
But you have to know their true name.
Yeah, okay.
Not just their
now this is getting, this is not simple anymore.
Right, okay. But they didn't mention the true name in here, or rituals, or demons. Just...
what is happening?
It's really like... anyone in this room, could have sat down and wrote this article off the top of their head just making shit up that sounds good. That's basically what it was.
But actually, probably people in this room have more expertise about how to debunk this, right?
Than probably some, everybody in this room.
Yeah,
absolutely. But that's... In the early days of the New England Skeptical Society, we would get, asked to participate in this sort of thing. And we did, because why not, But, we got asked to, investigate a haunted house.
Several.
And to, go to a graveyard where their ghosts are appearing. Lots of ghosts are, the big thing in New England, by the way. I don't know if you know that. I mean, it's kind of everywhere, but there are cultural differences and regional differences.
Warrens are from Connecticut.
Definitely New England ghost.
Well, Salem, all that
stuff. Yeah, because of that, just the history, it's very big. The Warrens, hail from there. Okay. All right, Rachy. So I'm interested, you have some interesting ideas about why maybe you guys have been a little bit more successful recently than your American counterparts or issues.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of grassroots activism in Australia, which many of you know, but we, through Australian Skeptics Incorporated and through Stop the Australian Vaccination Network, or SAVN, we campaign against misinformation that is spread by anti-vaxxers. And I've lived in this country now for about 2 years, and every time I'd give lectures before I moved here, people would say to me, what can we do to be as successful as you guys have been in Australia, because we have been extremely successful in quashing the spread of the anti-vax movement in Australia. And that has led to things like policy change at the level of government and interventions that really have actually translated into increased vaccination rates of kids. So just to cover a little bit of background, we recently, our government introduced a policy called No Jab, No Pay. And that means if you're not up to date with your immunizations, you don't get a tax benefit. So you actually lose money at the end of the day. And there was a lot of debate about this policy before it was introduced. And people were saying it's a coercive policy. You need a carrot, not a stick. It's not going to work. And the very early results show that 200,000 more kids have been vaccinated.
Wow. Okay.
Interesting to me how anti-vaxxers are so convinced that they won't vaccinate. As soon as you say there's money involved, they're like, okay, then it's fine.
Yeah.
It's so principled, But I think it's a unique environment that we have in Australia, which is extremely different to here. And I didn't really fully understand it, and I don't still, but since I've been here, I've been trying to just observe and work out what some of the major differences are that may have contributed to the success we have. I think one of those things, first of all, is that the freedom of speech issue here is sacrosanct in that sense. So in Australia, we do not have freedom of speech in our constitution. But aside from that, we have journalists who are quite happy to just shut anti-vaxxers down and not interview them, not speak to them. Whereas here, it seems to me more that there's very much an attitude of, but everyone should have the opportunity to present their opinion. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Australia, they're like, no, not necessarily. One of the other things that I think is really different and I think is really important in contributing to the way the media and the government deals with anti-vaxxers is we have socialized healthcare. So it actually costs our government money if people don't vaccinate. And so they're trying to protect the public health system. And so they're simply saying, well, we're not going to give you money if you don't vaccinate. And they can do that. They can punish people because we have free healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge difference, I think.
But let me speak to that, though, because it's more complicated than what you're saying. Because in the U.S., insurance companies foot the bill for stuff, and they don't want to pay for stuff that doesn't work either.
True.
So what happens is they don't. They say, no, we're not paying for this because it doesn't work, And then people lobby the state legislature to pass laws to force them to pay for it. So it's still being decided at the government level to pay for alternative medicine over the heads, basically, of the insurance companies. And my concern would be if, you know, the more the government is in control of those decisions, we're still going to have to fight the same fight, you know, and it might be partly that, you know, we have 50 fights to fight because it's every state, whereas, because basically states run healthcare in our country, not the government, not the federal government.
Well, we have both. We have levels at state level and federal level. So some of our laws are instigated at a federal and then the state follows. I would say the other thing that really contributes to the success of the anti-vax movement here is simply money. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got people like Dr. Oz and McCullough, and we saw a picture of Mike Adams before. These people have huge amounts of money to throw at this stuff. And recently we've had Vaxxed coming to Australia, and that's really interesting because they are bankrolled by Andrew Wakefield and Polly Tommy, who don't have a shortage of money. And so we actually managed to disrupt them quite significantly to the point where we actually got Polly Tommy banned from re-entering Australia for 3 years. Her visa was cancelled as she was escorted out of the country. And that was incredible. And that has really disrupted her plans to come back to Australia and set up autism trusts in Australia.
Did they, like, put her on a raft and, like, push it away?
They actually pushed it to New Zealand. They went. And in fact, we had in the country... Del Bigtree wouldn't come, by the way, because he said he was busy on other projects, but also we think he's had some visa issues. They did all of this in secret too because they knew if we found out they were intending to come that we would find a way to stop them. So they came, but then they got banned anyway. But Susan Humphreys also came, but there was some kind of falling out between her and Polly Tommy within Australia and New Zealand, and we don't know exactly what happened, but Susan Humphreys since has left the Vax tour in America and just disappeared off the face of the earth. We think she may have copped a ban as well, but we don't know. But the other thing that's interesting is that we've been watching all the videos, myself not personally, but other people have, and Polly Tommy has said on video that she is banned not just from Australia but from all Commonwealth countries now as a result of this ban. And we can't find any evidence that a ban in one country would replicate into other Commonwealth countries. There's no precedent for that we can find. So if that's true, that sets a huge precedent. But in addition to that, that would quash any plans that she had to go into India because Andrew Wakefield was talking about taking the Vaxxed bus into India on the back of the fact that the Gates Foundation is no longer welcome in India and they were funding a lot of the immunisation programs there.
Why did that happen?
It was because the Indian government was worried that there was conflicts of interest in, even though they're not a profit, but that they would be influencing policy too much that private companies, I'm not really sure of the details, but yeah, they're not in there anymore. So Wakefield saw an opening and was like, well, let's get the Vaxxed bus in there. So anyway, Polly Tommy's not allowed back in Australia, which is, you know, we're quite happy with that. That kind of thing, you can't stop here, you know. Yeah. However, she is, by the way, she's on a green card in America. She's not a citizen here. So I'm not sure how that's going to affect down the track her potential to renew her green card if she's been banned from another country. Don't know.
Take a closer look, maybe. And
well, you guys can report her to Border Force like someone in Australia did. I don't know who.
Rachel, do you feel like your government, the people in the government are more reasonable, rational than the U.S.?
Share of loonies as well. In fact, I don't know if any of you guys know, but we did have a guy who just actually lost his position in the government like 2 days ago. But he was a freeman on the land, a conspiracy theorist. He went up against Professor Brian Cox in Australia. I don't know, does anyone remember this? And it went pretty much viral because he wanted to have a debate with Professor Brian Cox about the evidence for climate change. And Brian Cox was just like, you're a numpty mate, it's not going to happen. But we do generally, on a percentage basis, maybe have more rational politicians, yeah. But the thing is, we have worked, Stop the Australian Vaccination Network have worked to create those relationships.
Yeah.
And we do a lot of stuff behind the scenes that we can't talk about and we don't have to. But we have curated relationships with journalists. So we feed stories to the media. Yeah. So they don't have to do it. And that's so great for journalists because if they don't have to go and seek out stuff and then write stories about talk to the dead and stuff, they've got a story fed to them, they'll publish it. Yeah.
But you were telling me the other night or last night that the media is different, right? You still have traditional media in the way that things were maybe 20 years ago in the U.S. And you can make those relationships. In the U.S. today, it's you know hundreds or thousands of media sources you'd have to have a relationship with.
It's so overwhelming here that I don't think you could even, a drop in the ocean would be that. You know, I mean, we only have what, we have one national newspaper and three or four others that, we only have Fairfax and Murdoch, so there's not that many people in the mix anyway.
Right. Well, there's like 100 people in Australia, right?
There are 100. yeah. But one of the other things we have done successfully over many, many years is report practitioners to their regulatory bodies when they do stuff. Mm-hmm. And that has been really successful. And in the last, I have a list here, we've had the registration suspended of two general practitioners in the last 6 months mm-hmm. and a chiropractor. And that is purely based on their anti-vaccination propaganda. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is really a boon for us, actually, is the anti-vaccination network themselves, because one of these GPs who got suspended, the reason he did was because he was speaking at a rally and saying he would sign fraudulent exemptions for patients so that they could get the money from the government, and he would basically say your child is vaccinated when the kid wasn't, right?
Wow.
But the anti-vaxxers filmed that and broadcasted it. And we were like, thank you. So, and the thing is, they are partly responsible for the introduction of a lot of new legislation because they do stupid stuff like that. And so all we have to do is just take it and pass it on to the correct people.
Right. Yeah.
So they have been really great for us.
You know? Keep up the good work.
So, yeah. You have just dumber anti-vaxxers than we do.
Possibly. but we've also had... it's also resulted in policy now where a lot of the regulatory boards for like nurses and midwives, for example, we have a particular problem with nurses and midwives being anti-vax. And the Midwives Association has now stood up and made a policy, and also they've made a social media policy that says you cannot comment outside of your area of expertise on social media, and you cannot make anti-vaccination comments.
Wow.
And so we just troll Facebook for 5 minutes and then make a screenshot and send it to their board, and we've currently got one nurse suspended for that.
Yeah.
And there's a whole, there's, in fact, at the moment, our regulatory body, which is the Australian Healthcare Practitioners Association, they have a backlog of 1,800 complaints, most of which came from Australian skeptics and other people. Mm-hmm. And they had to employ more people to deal with the complaints that they've been getting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, did I hear you correctly? Did they, in essence, say if somebody says something stupid on social media, they're going to do something about it?
Yeah.
You know what that would take in America to police? That would be off the charts.
Well, the other thing that we managed, not only us, but what has changed is that you used to be able to conscientiously object to vaccination on a philosophical grounds, right? And there used to be a religious exemption. And we don't really have any religions in Australia that actually don't allow you to vaccinate. But you could just say, look, I don't feel like doing it, and the government would let you take the money anyway. They've removed that clause now.
Yeah,
that's great.
So there's no loophole left. And this is what I was saying earlier. I find that really interesting because the anti-vaxxers don't seem to be, you know, their principles seem to be pretty loose because they're like, we're never going to vaccinate. And then it's like, well, we're taking away $2,000. Okay, we'll vaccinate. So, you know.
Everyone has a price, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, but to summarize, I think it's a completely different climate.
Yeah.
So you really can't translate what we do there to here. It's a huge, I mean, for a start, your population is just huge. I mean, it's funny because Australia is about the same size as America, right? But we have nothing in the middle. Like just some... 100 people.
Is it 23 million people?
24 million, yeah.
24 million. Yeah.
Wow. 320 million in America?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, there's two differences, and I think they're related to each other, and a lot of it is cultural and regulatory, which flows from the cultural differences. Like, if I complained about somebody speaking outside their area of expertise, nothing would happen.
Yeah.
Because they would say, well, they have academic freedom. You know, the freedom thing is like, that's the go-to defense.
That's right, yeah.
And I have complained. I mean, over the last 20 years, I've submitted plenty of complaints to state boards of health. I've been an expert witness on trials for state boards of health trying to act against physicians and complained to the FDA, to the FTC. And there just isn't the political will to ultimately act on it. And even when the regulators are interested, they get blocked by the legislature.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's tough because we basically, it's kind of what I was talking about yesterday, is that we were kind of behind the eight ball in that score. The other side, which is well-funded, has done a really good job of sort of blocking us out by saying, oh, nope, freedom, you can't stop us from saying, well, we want to stop. Nope, this is acceptable. You can't, they've really blocked the regulatory agencies. And so I think we can maybe learn from what you guys, I think, have had a lot of more positive feedback. So you're doing what works. We're trying to do the same things, but it's not working. So it's hard to keep doing it. We have to figure out what we do need to do.
I think money and lobbying.
But it might just be 10 times harder or maybe 50 times harder in the U.S. But I think we still have to do that. We have to start moving the conversation to, well, sure, freedom is great, and we absolutely 100% endorse freedom of speech and all that, but there still needs to be standards, and people need to be held to standards of expertise, and there's professional standards, and there's academic standards, and those should not be thrown away in this vague reference to freedom.
I mean, this whole issue around freedom of speech comes up a lot with this issue, and freedom of speech doesn't entitle you to a platform, right?
Yeah.
So you can, it's like the people that, say, they say I'm being suppressed from their column in the national newspaper in Australia, It's like, I don't think so. That comes up a lot. But I just wanted to mention one other thing before we move on, and that is that this is really kind of bragging, really. But we have, in the last 7 years that we've been doing this, we've had 10 peer-reviewed publications on this issue, and we've presented at 5 conferences with posters on the impact that we've had on the anti-vax movement, because actually we've received a fair bit of pushback from academics who don't like the way that we approach this issue. And so we've sort of been pushed into a position where we had to present evidence for the efficacy of what we're doing, because otherwise we'd be hypocrites, let's face it. So we have done studies showing that we have had actually an impact on the financial health of these organisations and their reach in the media. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we all also spend quite a bit of time doing is getting anti-vax papers retracted from the literature. Which
all
is
very
so
important. We're very, very important.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we write papers in response to rubbish that appears in the literature, and if it's really bad, we try to get it retracted.
Yeah.
And we've had quite a lot of success doing that.
I think we've had a lot of success in that as well. There's usually a pretty immediate backlash against really bad papers like the Seralini paper, et cetera, and they do end up getting retracted once we point out, nope, that's actually a piece of crap paper. You should probably retract
it. I mean, the problem is that sometimes papers that are retracted get cited more after they've been retracted than...
Yeah, we just wrote about that.
It's called the backfire effect.
Zombie studies that get cited after they've been retracted. I wrote about that on Science-Based Medicine. There was one article that was terrible. It was cited 600 times. More than half of the citations were after it was retracted.
Mm. That's the same for the Wakefield paper.
Yeah.
It continues to get cited.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, good on you, Dr. Rachel.
Good on you, mate. Yeah, no worries, mate.
Yeah.
Do I have an American accent yet, or is it still standing?
No, not at all.
You have to get a Minnesota accent, you know.
That was terrible. Then. Right. So, conspiracy theories is one thing that we deal with, and we like to keep track of the science of the things that we study. And so there was a paper that came out recently put together a number of studies trying to tease apart what is it that leads somebody to believe in conspiracies. Mm-hmm. And essentially, just to back up a little bit, essentially what's happening is a combination of hyperactive pattern detection, right, which we talk about. We are pattern recognizing machines. We're good at seeing things. It's seeing signal in random noise, because our brains are sort of wired to do that. It's massive parallel processors, really good at comparing lots of things simultaneously. And it's like, yeah, that looks like a face, and so you see a face, right? That's a simple example of that. But the same is true of events, of things happening. We sort of see a pattern in events, And we say these are all connected. There's an underlying cause for all of these things. We also have what's called hyperactive agency detection. We think that that cause has a deliberate agent underneath it. There isn't some default, natural cause. There's somebody deliberately tying these things together. There's one, conspiracy behind it all. But we also have a logical, rational side in what we neuroscientists call reality testing. That's literally what it's called. Parts of our brain that go, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. That breaks the laws of physics, or it's implausible, or, psychology or human motivation is probably a better explanation for that, or whatever.
Isn't that our baloney detector?
It's our baloney detector, yeah.
But that's the part of the brain that's shut off when you're dreaming. Yeah. So if you're dreaming and you see a pink elephant in the supermarket, you're like, oh, that's cool, and you wouldn't even think twice about it because that's been shut off.
So that sucks. We're not skeptics when we're dreaming.
No. Believe everything.
So it's hard to make sense of your dream when you're awake, because you're a different person when you're awake. Different parts of your brain are working.
So I got to tell a quick side note. I was having a semi-lucid dream, and in the dream, Bob was saying to me, Jay, this isn't me. This is just an amalgamation of all your memories of me. Like, Bob is educating me in my dream.
I'm awesome even in dreams.
Yeah, I love it.
So we know that we set up this hyperactive sort of conspiracy detection, and then we pull it back with our reality testing. That's how it's supposed to work. Which makes sense if you think about it, because we want to detect all the patterns that are out there. So we want to have a real sensitive pattern detection, but we don't want false positives. So we have to then weed out the false positives so that we're left with all the true positive patterns, right? That would be an optimally functioning, cognitive machine. Our cognitive machines are not optimally functioning, however.
But it's better that you're biased more towards being oversensitive than undersensitive, right?
As long as you have the filter, as long as you have the reality filter in place, right? And there's a balance. There's got to be a balance there, just like anything. The psychologists have been debating about, so for people who are conspiracy theorists, are they detecting more patterns, or are they rejecting too few patterns? Or both? Is their pattern recognition increased, or is their reality testing decreased, or is it both of those things at the same time?
My guess is both.
Yeah. So that's my guess too. But this study was looking specifically at the hypothesis that people who believe in conspiracy theories or believing in conspiracy theories correlates with increased pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. That component of the hypothesis. Right?
And didn't they also say though that a big component here was a lack of a sex life?
Yes. They in a way, in a roundabout way, they did.
Oh, really?
Yes. I know, you're shocked. But in a roundabout way. And what I mean by that is that when people feel threatened or have threatened self-esteem or feel like the world is not working for them, their conspiracy belief goes way up.
Well, now I feel bad.
Yeah. So, but you had this intuition that, losers believe in conspiracy theories, and that, I know that's a colloquial term, but that's exactly what the research shows.
Okay.
That it's serious. So in any case, they did a series of studies where they had people looking for patterns in like random noise. Now, not conspiracy patterns, just like coin tosses. They would generate random signals with coin tosses or other things like that. And then they would have see if people see patterns in the noise, and there was a baseline. And then if your tendency to believe in conspiracies, like endorsing certain conspiracy thinking, correlated positively with seeing more patterns in randomly generated noise.
That is cool.
Yeah, even though it has nothing to do with conspiracy.
But theory. Did they think also that the people that were running the test were like messing with that? No, seriously.
Yeah, it's
probably.
That's why it's so hard to do this kind of research, because there's all those layers. Then what they found was that they increased their belief in conspiracies using standard psychological techniques. You prime people, you have them read stuff where, it suggests to them. And then when their conspiracy beliefs were increased artificially in the context of the study, their pattern recognition increased also.
Oh,
so the, it kind of, there was not just a correlation, they were able to actually manipulate it a little bit.
So don't be surprised if you see coin toss gate.
Yeah, coin toss gate, right, yeah. So anyway, it's a little very focused of the series of research that they did. It was just looking at this one thing. Is there the cognitive process of pattern recognition, is it involved with conspiracy thinking? And they concluded that, yeah, it is. It is involved. Now, that doesn't mean that the reality testing isn't an important component. It wasn't 100% correlation. It didn't. They specifically said, this doesn't explain the entire phenomenon of believing in conspiracies, but there is absolutely an effect there. And that's why I had the same reaction that you did, Kara, and I wrote, when I wrote about this, I said, usually when the question is, like in psychology, is it A or is it B, the answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah, because people are complicated, and pretty much every permutation that you can think of is playing some role in the overall phenomenon, so not surprising.
And it's nearly impossible. It's like, I don't know if it's ever happened where there's a psychological study that explains 100% of the variance within the group.
Never.
Yeah, it's just, it wouldn't happen.
Or not happen.
Yeah. So, first, I think it's cool that they're doing this type of study, but is it, are they leading towards maybe some type of cure or medication?
Cure for conspiracy?
No, I know that, but think about it. Like, I'm just trying to.
Like improved therapeutic intervention.
Well, like what would they do to help these people?
Well, I mean, I think some of them probably already benefit from therapeutic intervention. Like people who have conspiratorial thinking to the extent that it's like delusional thinking and things like that.
You're talking about when it gets to the point where it's like a diagnosable entity that needs professional help.
But I think
there's a vast gray zone, you know, and we're all, I mean, I think there's a little conspiracy theorist in all of us, right? We all tend to have one eye out for the conspiracy and we tend to see patterns. No, seriously.
No, it's
adaptive.
Keep it in check,
it's adaptive. You think about it. Sometimes people are conspiring against you, right? Yeah. Whatever that is, at work or whatever, and you need to have your radar up for like, this is not random. This is like, these people are campaigning against me or whatever. That's real.
Yeah, anybody who has ever been gaslighted, like, that's what that is.
Yeah,
but it goes hand in hand to think that you would go to say, let's, you know, I can think of a few examples of people I know pretty well who are, you know, really heavy into conspiracies. And I don't feel like I could ever go up to them and say, hey, let's work on this thing you have going on because you're a conspiracy theorist, because they don't think they're a conspiracy theorist.
That's true. I mean, that's delusional people never think they're delusional, right? That's almost by definition, they don't have the insight. But the authors do get into the fact, and they do conclude that the ultimate solution to conspiratorial thinking is critical thinking, right? That's the solution. That's the reality filter part of it.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, so skepticism and critical thinking is the answer. Yeah. That's what the answer is.
Yeah, but what the hell does that mean? Like, we can't just say, hey, we're going to inject you with, you know, skepticism.
No. It's doing everything that we're doing. That's the answer.
Not doing what we're doing, but how about...
We need to promote... We need to promote critical thinking in general.
Okay,
right?
We put our message out, and that would help influence these other people.
To whatever degree we give people critical thinking tools, they will be less inclined to believe in conspiracy
theories. I don't know. I'm skeptical of that.
You think so?
No. Well, legitimately, I guess I'm going to like the extremes, because the people that really stand out in my life that are. You know, really.
At the extreme end, where it's pathological.
You're never going to
change. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about rank and file.
It is interesting, though, that I wonder how strong the correlation is between critical thinking, evidence-based thinking, rational thinking, and intelligence. Because I do know a lot of people who are highly intelligent people who are the most extreme conspiracy, theorists.
They can rationalize very well.
Yeah, first of all, intelligence is not a thing, right? It's not just one thing.
But there are measures of intelligence.
Yeah.
And things like
some
that.
Measures of intelligence actually. So it's a double-edged sword, right? Because it can offer you critical thinking tools, but it can also offer you a powerful mechanism for motivated reasoning and rationalizing and justifying your conspiracy thinking or whatever pseudoscientific thinking that you have. And so it depends on how you use it.
Absolutely.
It's not a panacea. It's not about just being smarter or knowing more things. You need to literally have critical thinking tools that you can apply to yourself. And until you get to that point, nothing really helps.
It's the introspection. That's the important part, right? Sorry to interrupt, but some of the best marketing techniques out there are basically people using critical thinking for evil. You know what I mean?
So there are
ways that you can actually use those same skills to convince people of things that are nefarious. So
that's where all the money is.
Exactly. but being able to turn that around and say, I myself fall victim to these biases and things, that's the hard part of the puzzle.
I would like to quantify it and come to, like, how do we handle this? And Steve, you and I and George were on a panel. I think it was at Nexus, and we actually talked about, like, what would we need to do?
Yeah.
Like, how can we change the world, right?
Right.
And it boils down to education.
Yeah.
Like, having it be something that people have to, you know, every year in school there's some type of critical thinking class. Like, I think that's a tangible goal that we could get to.
Jay, were you on that that panel? I'm pretty sure that was Steve and me
panel.
And George on that.
No, no.
Oh, you were also.
We did it twice.
Oh, you did it twice. Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so
I'm like a weird false memory right now. Okay, but, we both yeah, talked about
it's
that.
It's education, but at every level of life. It's not just in the school. It's absolutely adult education. It's marketing. It's you know the media.
But getting into the canon of education.
Well, and in the zeitgeist itself. Yeah, because it's not in politics at all.
Right.
And so, but if we could see that the most influential people in our society and culture also embodied those types of qualities.
Oh,
yeah. That helps.
Bob, what am I looking at here?
That's a pit on the moon that's kind of been a little mysterious over the years. It looks kind of really deep, and people have been saying that, oh, maybe there's an actual like tube under there, some void. So this is what my story is about. So this is about a study that was released in the science journal Geophysical Research Letters recently, and they reveal that they have found pretty much really good evidence that city-sized lava tubes exist on the moon. That could one day protect future moon-based alpha inhabitants. I mean, this story really, really resonated with me. I talked about it on the show 2 years ago that these things could be on the moon, and now they've essentially found it. So the story is, this is how they found it. So there's a Japanese lunar probe called Selene, and it took some radar images of the moon, and they're looking at the radar images, and they looked at this area where this is called Marius Hill Skylight. And because they said
skylight,
yeah,
I love that.
It's kind of like an opening,
yeah.
Right?
Roof, yeah.
So they looked at the radar image and they saw a very distinctive like drop in the radar echo, and then a spike, an echo spike coming back at the end, which is kind of diagnostic of like there's some void there. But Selene wasn't really optimized for this type of research. So JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, went to NASA and said, "Hey, we need some of your GRAIL scientists." And the GRAIL scientists had a lunar spacecraft that did a really detailed gravitational map of the moon, and they said, "We need to look at that data." So they looked at the data, and the gravity map of the moon in that area said that there's less gravity there. There's a lunar mass deficit in that area. So that was like the radar image and this gravitational GRAIL image was kind of like a 1-2 punch of really saying that there's something here. So clearly, either there's like a buried, you know, alien monolith under the ground, or some big void.
And either way, it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but
those are the only two options,
yeah,
by the way.
Of course, those are the only two. It's obvious.
Bob, I got a couple questions. Yeah. So are they surmising like that we could eventually build like a station in there?
Yes. Sure, sure.
That's
and
the whole idea.
Right. But the thing is, GRAIL, because GRAIL even found something like this, it has to be immense, because GRAIL it's sensitive, but it's not so sensitive that they can find like a small burrow. If it detects something, it's got to be big. So this is like at least three kilometers, and there might be even multiple lava tubes.
This is like an iceberg effect. So how big is that actual hole? Like what are we looking at? The skylight itself.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how wide that is.
Okay, so
I'm not sure
it's
why
bigger.
That is.
It's a big opening.
It's big.
Yes, and then underneath
opening.
It, it's even bigger.
Right, yes, and it's clearly, if you look at it, you could kind of see that some rocks have fallen on the bottom, and it doesn't look like a crater, right? It looks like an incredibly deep, deep crater. So that they think that's an opening now to this lava tube. But the thing is, you may be thinking, well, okay, there's a lava tube, so what? But the reasoning behind it, why this is important, is I think it's really fascinating. The moon, basically, the surface of the moon sucks. It is horrible. You think, oh, the moon is fun. You remember the astronauts leaping around. But it's really a horrible place. For a few days, it's great. But if you're going to stay there more than a few days, it is deadly. It's beyond deadly. First off, there's the regolith, which is the moon dust, which is like nasty stuff. The astronauts hated it. It got everywhere. But it's also tiny, like talc.
What?
The astronauts hated that
stuff.
It's coarse.
And it gets everywhere.
Oh, Jay. Yeah, but Jay, I'm starting with the little stuff, and I'm going to build
so
up
depressing,
this
Jay.
Stuff. Okay, imagine inhaling this and getting it deep in your lungs. It's also kind of semi-radioactive.
Yeah. Somewhat
would
radioactive.
You be okay with that? Also, it's sharp like glass. So imagine you're on the moon and you get a cut on your cornea. Like, oh crap, my doctor is 200 and a quarter of a million miles away. What are you going to do? That's
you
not good.
You can't touch it, you know, because you got the helmet.
Right. But it can also give you cancer. I mean, it's
wait,
really...
Wait, the moon can give you cancer?
Well, I mean, it can make you... Yes. It can increase the probability that, like asbestos, like that you're going to get cancer.
Oh,
so this is nasty stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it gets even worse because you've got ionizing radiation, and that's not the good radiation. This is the bad radiation. Yeah. The protons and electrons that come from mainly three sources. You've got the solar wind from the sun, which is kind of constant, but it's cumulative. It's like if you're exposed to it for a long time, it's going to cause problems. There's no magnetosphere, remember, like we have around the Earth. It's just like bare space, essentially, on the surface of the moon. Then there's also solar flares, which are even more energetic. And if you're caught in a solar flare, you are in trouble. And then there's also the galactic cosmic rays, which are even worse. They're even more energetic. And your suit's not going to really protect you from any of that stuff.
Bob, you sound like Gimli describing Mordor.
Yeah.
So my concern is, looking at that, my first really big concern, though, is that if we ever tried to investigate it, a giant space worm would come out like on Star Wars.
Yeah. Right?
Sure. Yeah. And it's tube-shaped. It's like worm-shaped. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's good, Steve. But it's even worse than that. So first off, you got the galactic cosmic rays, but they can even hit the ground, and then your feet get showered with secondary neutron radiation. So it's just like not good no matter how you look at it. And I haven't even talked about the meteoroids. Did I talk about the meteoroids yet? No, I didn't. So they're small. They're not really, they can be big, but they're generally not that big, but they're like traveling at 1,100 miles an hour, which no spacesuit, even if you're Iron Man, is not going to protect you. And even habitat can take damage from something
like
that's traveling that fast.
Yeah.
But you don't even need to get hit, because if your moon base alpha is over here and the micrometeoroids hit here, the ejecta from that can actually damage your
that's
habitat.
That's how you get the cornea.
So, yeah, right. So it's really just... if you're going to be on the surface of the moon, like Space 1999 with their moon base alpha, it's going to have to be a really beefy surface habitat, really expensive to build. And scientists have looked at these habitats and they've said, all right, if we're going to really build this habitat, maybe we need to bury some of it. And it's like, yes, that's exactly it. And that's what these lava tubes are, because now you're burying everything, scores of meters below the surface. So you're protected from the regolith, because there's no regolith that deep. You're also protected from everything I've said, the ionizing radiation, but also the temperature swings on the surface. There's like a 300 degree temperature swing. So you'll be kind of insulated from that. But you can also do like pristine experiments under there of the composition of the moon and things. I mean, to me, this is like such a no-brainer.
And could you seal the mouth and like pressurize the whole thing?
That sounds problematic.
So dangerous.
Yeah. But the idea, Steve, you can build a habitat underneath that doesn't need to be nearly as beefy as what you would need on the surface.
But you're
pretty tents under there.
Bob, what about, is there any heat coming from the center of the moon?
The moon, I don't know.
Does anybody know?
It's not totally cold. It is solidified.
There's a little bit.
Okay. It's not active, but the center
is not. I'm not sure. Capture the energy.
It's not completely,
Okay.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, you're not going to get too much geothermal energy out of the moon.
Lunar thermal enough to heat up your living room.
Luna thermal.
But then the final thing that I liked about this is that this whole idea of the lava tubes really reinforces this major shift that we're seeing in the United States and in other countries, turning away from Mars in a lot of ways and focusing more on the moon, which we've been talking about for years. People were talking about going to Mars, and I said, why are you talking about going to Mars? We can really get our stuff together on the moon first, dealing with this radiation, dealing with just living away so far from the Earth, but only be 3 days away. Yeah. I mean, if you break a bone, if something bad happens, I mean, you're really just 3 days away from serious help. Whereas if you're on Mars, we'll see in about, a year, 14, 16 months or whatever. So I think these lava tubes can really play a great role in learning what we need to learn to live off Earth before we go to Mars.
So we need to send a mission to that hole, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Jay.
Yes.
You were going to tell us about T-Rex, and you wanted me to display an anatomically correct representation.
I did. Yeah,
we've learned a lot of things about T-Rex recently. We found out they're made out of plastic.
Yeah.
That they have a really funny voice. Yeah.
I do have another slightly better.
This is a little more accurate. There you go.
Oh, hold on. Yeah.
So this is a news item about the anatomy of the arms, the T-Rex arms. And, I'm sure a lot of people have seen them and were like, what's with the baby arms? Like, why did T-Rex have these short little arms? So scientists have been doing some research to try to figure some details out. So I thought, let me just give you some basic information about T-Rex that you may or may not know. So they lived in what is now Western North America. They lived 68 to 66 million years ago. They were among the last non-avian dinosaurs, Steve.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, just letting you know. They were they were a bipedal carnivore, which I think everybody here knows. They were big. They were 12.3 meters long and up to 3.5 meters tall, or 12 feet tall on the hips. 8 to 4 metric tons, and that's about the weight of a large backhoe. You know, like mm-hmm. you know, a big machine like that. That's heavy. So it was one of the largest theropods, and most researchers believe that it had the strongest bite force of all terrestrial animals ever.
Right.
Wow. Really, number one.
Yeah, I think only that shark, the megalodon, was more bite.
Okay, yeah, but right, you know, that's it was nasty.
Yeah.
And they, you know, there's been an argument also about whether was T-Rex a apex predator or a scavenger. Mm-hmm. And they've been batting it back and forth for a long time. And I think the current knowledge is that it was largely a predator, that if it found food, it would eat it.
Which is like most predators.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Kind of like, I would do that too. That's the way I would.
And our ancestor did do that.
Yeah. They did. So their little, tweaky little arms, they were a meter long. And some scientists think that they were vestigial. Mm-hmm. You know, from a previous version. So a paleontologist named Stephen Stanley at the University of Hawaii at Manoa argued that the small limbs were actually well adapted for close combat, and they had great slashing ability with the nasty claws that they had. So ancestors of the T-Rex had longer arms and most likely used them for grasping. So they would use them like a hand, kind of. But over time, they started to grasp with their mouth, which mm-hmm. makes sense. And some theorize that the arms were just a remnant from that time period, only used for maybe mating, maneuvering, or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make any jokes you want in your mind about that. So the scientist Stanley, he made some points about the arms. He said, no, they were actually very muscular. Mm-hmm. He said that they had robust bones, and they were both, you know, strong enough to take damage from battling, so that the arms were good for battling, but also can take damage.
I remember reading years ago their arms were indeed very strong. In fact, they said that they could like curl. Like what would you think an average human can curl for their biceps? Like 40 pounds maybe? He said that they can probably curl 200 pounds. So these were beefy arms.
Yeah.
At least on a human scale, they were pretty strong.
I would think it would be more than
much
that.
More.
That sounds low.
He said, that's what I read, 200 pounds.
Interesting.
Updated analysis may change that, though. But.
So the other thing he mentioned was that both arms had two claws about 10 centimeters long. And in this case, two claws is actually better than three or more, because if you think about it, when it comes down with the claws, there's only two points of contact, and each one of them would have more energy in it from the arm swing.
Right.
So instead of spreading it out like a larger mm-hmm. animal, mm-hmm. I think a very
so
have
two
point.
Deeper cuts rather than three more superficial cuts.
Interesting.
And it evolved to optimize.
Like the steak hook, mm-hmm. you know, like the meat hook that you use when you're cooking.
If he could attack with his claws, why wouldn't he just to attack with his real weapon, his mouth?
I would imagine, if this scientist is correct, that it was doing all of that at the same time. You know, you're getting it up here,
you can bite
it,
clamp on, and while it's biting, just like...
Well, yeah, think about all of the different ways that organisms kill.
Yeah.
You know, some of them, like if you ever watch a cat, they'll bite the neck and then they'll disembowel with their claws.
With
you know what I mean? So there might be, just alternatives.
All right, but Jay, then
there.
Why does Wolverine have three claws, though?
I thought he had four. He only
has
three.
Steve, Wolverine's not real.
I keep getting confused. All right.
I guess because there's three spaces there.
Yeah,
but it's,
I guess so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So the claws also had a bevel that were sharp and similar to a bear's claw. So this is actually for doing physical damage to tissue.
They had the features of an attack weapon.
What does that mean, a bevel? Is that like it's serrated?
Yeah, it had bevels in it, so it would cut. It was a slashing implement.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay.
In contrast to an eagle's claw, which is more for grasping. And if you look at an eagle's claw, now they look nasty, but they do have like this hook shape, so that it's good for grabbing onto branches. It's good for grabbing onto fish and prey and things like that.
But these are more straight. They're like...
But
curled.
There is still a raging debate. Some scientists are not agreeing with these findings, and they're still saying, the arms were really not that powerful. But, this is science. You know, we're seeing people come up with theories.
But it has a compelling argument to make,
I think
it sounds.
So.
And, you know, when you look at them again, so, they're tiny compared to the body, but they still look like they could have been effective, especially at close up, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine, a human, a tall human, 6-foot human, would be right about where the knee is.
Yeah.
Now imagine that mouth coming down on you.
And think about this too. So what I wonder if there were prey or enemies of the T-Rex that could get like inside its mouth, right? Yeah. So as you know, if you have a really big weapon, the one way you deal with it is you get inside. You get too close for them to use the big weapon, but then he has the close-up weapons. So like you get inside, he'll screw you up with the arms, right? So
that makes sense.
That makes sense.
I never heard anyone talk about the feet. I guess they didn't attack with the feet.
No, I think they were for running.
Yeah.
And standing.
And there have been debates for
stomping
for a while about how fast could T Rex run, and the current consensus is pretty darn fast.
And also, was it more upright or was it
horizontal?
No, it was horizontal. Yeah.
So like, we used to think it was
the head and the tail balance each other, and the primary reason why their arms shrank was so that the head could have more weight with the same balance. Yeah. So the weight just shifted from the arms to the head. But again, that doesn't mean that the arms became completely useless. They just became co-opted for close-up secondary, weapons.
And the T-Rex is a true biped. Yeah. You know, a lot of other theropods were facultative bipeds. So they their arms were long enough that they could sort of use them if they needed to, but they mostly were bipedal. But he's a true biped. Like, he could not use his arms to walk. So in that sense, having them be longer might have meant that they were in the way, And you also sometimes see them illustrated, and I wonder how true to life this is, using their tail as a weapon. Mm-hmm. Like, it counterbalances their head as like a giant
but
whip.
It's still a big muscular whip.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, like it could really do some damage. Yeah.
All right. So, aren't they cute? Raccoons are adorable.
They're so cute.
Wait, that's your deck.
This is my deck, actually. So,
you need to paint you.
This
Steve.
Summer, I know. I don't get me started. So, this summer, there was a mommy raccoon and three baby raccoons visiting our deck every night. Yes, they were visiting.
Wait, no.
And, because they were friends with my dog, who liked to sit and bark at them, and they would stand there and look at him while he was barking. No, but they were coming after my bird feeders, right? And then there's no stopping them. There is no stopping the raccoons. They were throwing, they were taking that, you could see, like, I have a suet cage there. They would take it off of that hook.
Whoa.
They would take it off the hook, and they would open it up.
Suet cage. Sure.
Yeah. It's like a little rectangle of fat that you put in there for the birds.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's high density food. Yeah. So everyone's after that. We basically had to bring all of our bird feeders in at night. Mm-hmm. That's all. That was it. There was no way to keep them from
emptying
them. Yeah. So we had to just bring them in every single night. But they're adorable.
They're
so cute. They are. Yeah. And they were even a little bit bigger here when we first saw them. They were these little tiny baby raccoons. They were awesome.
Steve, can I add something to that? Yeah. We had the same problem.
Yeah.
So we every night we would fill up the bird feeders so that in the morning when the birds came at dawn there would be food for them, and we'd go out in the morning and there'd be no seed left. And so we put up a trail cam because we couldn't, because we had like a shepherd's hook that was on, so it was a fence that was kind of 6 foot high and then a shepherd's hook that hooked out over the edge of the garden.
That's what we had.
And so I said to my friends, there's no way raccoons can get that. And so we put out a trail cam and John got the video the next day, and there was a party. There was like five of them.
Yeah.
And they were actually climbing up onto the fence and then onto the shepherd's hook, and just like with their paws, they would empty that feeder every night.
Yeah.
See, this feeds really nicely into this news story, actually, that you said that story, because this news story is actually linked to quite a famous quote-unquote intelligence test. I don't know if intelligence is quite the right word to use, but a test of how easily different animals can kind of break a problem-solving mechanism. And so the test is called the Aesop's Fable test, because there's one Aesop's Fable in which there's a cow and he's thirsty, but he can't get the water out of the pitcher because the water level's too low. And then a bird comes along and drops stones in the bottom of it and it raises the water level and then they can drink. And so they've done this test before on some birds, mostly corvids, crows, ravens, scrub jays.
Really smart.
Yeah, who are really smart. And also, apes, great apes. And so they decided that they wanted to do this test on raccoons. I myself have raccoons on my property all the time. We have the trash cans, like most, I think, municipalities in the U.S. have, mm-hmm. where they're the trash cans with the big lid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've had to figure out how to, like, jimmy them underneath, because the raccoons open them every night yeah. and pull, but they're messy. It's like, if they would just be clean about it, I'd be okay if they were eating my, but there's, like, chicken bones, and I'm like, we haven't eaten chicken. Like, I don't know, where did that come from? And they're bold. Like, I remember pulling up into my driveway, and they're sitting there on top, just, and I'm literally like, go away, trash panda, like yelling at them.
Trash panda.
Well, they won't. They just look you in the eye. And they're like,
they will stare you down.
They don't care.
They did not give an inch to my big dog. They just stare
yeah,
you.
Yeah, they don't care.
So wait, I have a story.
Yes.
So my wife and I, our bedroom, like our driveway is right where below our bedroom. So we can hear everything that's going on where the trash bins are. Mm-hmm. So we heard thumping night after night after night. So one night, I go into the garage, and I'm like, I wanted to see what's going on. I figure it was raccoons. I open the garage, like 11 o'clock at night. I turn around again, and he snuck in behind me, grabbed a garbage bag that I was queued up to put into the bin the next morning because I was leaving garbage in the garage, and he ran off with a garbage bag.
Yeah.
No?
They're incredibly adaptive. Like, these are really, really adaptive animals. They've learned how to coexist yeah. in urban environments in a really impressive way. And so these researchers decided to give them this test. And you can kind of see in this picture the apparatus. So it's a really skinny tube, and the water level is so low that he can't reach his paw down to... I'm not sure if you can tell. It just looks like there's white scum on top of the water, but that's actually marshmallows.
Mm.
And so he really wants those marshmallows. But he can't quite reach them. And so the test is, if there are balls like lying about, will they think to drop the balls into the water to raise up the water level and then be able to reach the marshmallows? So 2 out of 10 raccoons figured out how to do it, which wow. is, you know, not most of them, but still impressive. Yeah. And then they were like, okay, let's up the ante a little bit, like they do with the corvids and with the apes, where they put some balls that sink and some balls that float. And they actually use, you know, very scientific terminology, and they call them functional objects and non-functional objects, because a ball that sinks will raise the water level, but a non-functional object, a ball that, gosh, this thing's falling off my ear. A non-functional object, a ball that floats, shouldn't raise the water level, just sit on top.
Yep.
But alas, these raccoons were like, screw your functional and non-functional objects. Multiple raccoons figured out how to just push the floaty ball up and down really fast and really hard, and the marshmallows would splash up onto the sides of the tube.
So it was a functional
yeah,
object.
Yeah, it became a functional object. And it would scrape them off the side of the tube and eat them. Another one figured out
wow.
that if it just rolled the ball at the top, it would scoop all of the marshmallows up and they would stick to the ball, and then it could eat them. Another one.
Wow.
And they knew that they would try to, like, pull the tube off. So it's really well fixed. Like, you can't take this thing apart. But another one figured out how to actually undo the base from the ground and knock the entire apparatus over.
Like they were doing to my bird feeders.
Exactly.
Wow.
To get in there. And so they realized that this paradigm for raccoon problem solving was not sufficient because they upended the test itself.
That's
right. They were smarter than the test.
Kobayashi Maru, they busted it.
Yeah.
So the researchers found out. The researchers found out that the raccoons were actually studying them.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. They found their lab notes the next day. It was really scary. And the funny thing is, there are other examples of organisms upending the test to some extent. There was a test with orangutans historically where they had the same tube, but there was no hard objects nearby. And so the orangutans realized, but there was water nearby, but they couldn't carry the water. There was no vessel to carry the water. So they would fill up their cheeks with water and go over and spit water into it, and that would raise the level.
Well, couldn't
to get
they just
them?
Pee in there too? That
and
would work.
And so one orangutan just pissed in it. Yeah. He figured out that was a much better. I guess he didn't mind that there was like pee all over the nuts that were floating at the top.
There were peanuts.
There were peanuts.
Peanuts.
Oh. There were peanuts. Yeah, so.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's actually literally the last line of this article.
Ha ha ha!
Nice. Oh, and I should specify. Sorry, I made a mistake there. The orangutans figured out how to spit the mouthfuls of water. It was actually a chimpanzee.
Yeah, it was a very chimpy kind of thing to do.
Yeah. So super interesting. Whenever there's a paradigm that animal researchers will develop, it's so neat to see that it's like you got to think of every single contingency.
So I bet you that raccoons are getting more intelligent as we try to thwart them, and the smart ones break our ways of keeping our food from them.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean,
they're going to be like the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, and we have to do this, right? In urban environments, like, I have to rig my trash can so that the raccoons can't open the lids.
And you'll figure out?
Yeah, if you've ever gone camping in parts of, like, the Pacific, when we go camping, there are bear boxes. In Northern California, we have black bears, and there are bear boxes at your campsite, right? Because the bears will rip into your car to get your food. They're super aggressive when it comes to food. And so the bear boxes are these special boxes where they can't fit their paw up inside of it to pull the hook and bring it down, but a human being can. So you have to get in front of these intelligent creatures.
Well, there's a bunch of raccoons in Wyoming that have managed to get a black bear into trouble, I reckon, because one of my friends is losing all his bird feed seed at night, and the rangers came through and said, oh, there's a black bear around here, man. And he put up his trail cam, and once again, it's party time with the raccoons. And so they've managed to blame a black bear, and I'm sure it's them. It's not a bear.
Well, that's over the hedge now. That's what you get into. All right. So, Evan, I understand that millennials, those damn millennials, they hate being called them. I have two daughters who are millennials. Like, don't call us.
What is with that stock photo, by the way? I don't know what stock photo.
This headline has two parts to it, a good part and a bad part. Why millennials are ditching religion, yay, for witchcraft and astrology, boo. Right. So, and they drew their data from our friends at Pew Research Center, and I call them our friends because the folks at Pew have told us that they like the work we do at SGU. Oh, so sure. That's why I call them our friends. So, good news first. Most U.S. adults now say it is not necessary to believe in God to be moral and have good values. 56% in the most recent survey, and that is up from 49% in 2011. The increase reflects the continued growth in the share of population that has no religious affiliation. It's also the result of changing attitudes among those who do identify with religion, and that includes evangelical Protestants, white evangelical Protestants. So that's part of the story. Right. Now, according to the National Science Foundation, more than half of the young adults in the United States believe astrology is a science.
No.
Get this now. Compare that to China, 8% of people in China.
But they believe in chi. I mean, that's just a cultural thing. Seriously, that's just, it's one or the other, right?
That is true. But it still is a sad commentary, I think, anyway you slice it. So the psychic services industry, which not only includes things like astrology, but aura readings, mediumship, tarot card readings, palmistry, all these things, it grew 2% between 2011 and 2016 in the United States. And the what they call the metaphysical services industry, that's a term, $2 billion annually.
The metaphysical services industry. Big metaphysical.
Sounds official. It's all crap.
It sounds like a role in a Tim Burton movie. You know what I mean?
That's right. You can't make this stuff up, can you? And there are, you know, the article itself cites some interesting examples. There is a Brooklyn-based metaphysical boutique. They cater to New Yorkers in their 20s. Their store offers workshops like Witchcraft 101, Astrology 101.
Is that what they're calling it?
Yes, and Spirit Seance.
Right, man.
Yes.
Amazing. It's not tongue-in-cheek.
No, quite serious. Another example, this woman, Banu Guler, the co-founder of an artificial intelligence-powered astrology app, which is called CoStar. October 12th, they launched, and it was so popular, their website crashed 3 times as they tried to, you know, get it up and for service for everyone.
Yeah. Well, that's what they said.
It
could have been they were incompetent, too.
Yeah, true. It's true. Could be that. And then, finally, a woman, Danielle Akoya, founder of the spiritual subscription service Mystic Lipstick. Her customer base is growing by leaps and bounds. The astrologer sells a Mystic Box subscription, which includes crystals, Reiki-infused bath salts, and incense customized, get this, to the unique energy of the current moon cycle. Mm-hmm. And you can subscribe to that service for $15 a month. She has seen a 75% increase in her customers in the last year.
Or you can get a premium membership of the SGU for only $8 a month. Just saying. But yes, I mean, I think what this shows, in my opinion, is that this reinforces the notion that we can't just fight one particular belief with information or facts, right? The underlying problem of critical thinking versus susceptibility to metaphysical beliefs. That's the issue. Otherwise, they're just going to shift over from one thing to some other thing.
Yeah, that's right, Stephen. You talked about that yesterday in your talk. You can't just, tell people, no, this isn't the way it goes. Here is how it actually is. You have to give them something else.
You have to give them something. You can't just debunk. We got to give them the skeptical narrative.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Exactly. All right, cool. We have time for science or fiction.
Yay!
It's time for science or fiction.
I have a theme. The theme is Las Vegas. Yay, a lot of Las Vegas experts out there. That was really pathetic. Yeah. All right, here we go. During World War II, this is item number one, by the way. During World War II, a Nazi plan to blow up the Hoover Dam was narrowly thwarted by an observant fisherman who reported the agent's suspicious activity. Item number two, Las Vegas serves 60,000 pounds of shrimp every day, more than the rest of the United States combined. Item number three, in the 1950s, atomic testing was conducted just 65 miles north of Las Vegas and was clearly visible from the casinos and promoted as a tourist attraction. So, as we do at live shows, I'm going to poll the audience, then we'll give our panel of experts, then I'll see how they influenced you. We're going to do the single clap when I drop my hand. So, if you think the one about the World War II plan to blow up the Hoover Dam is the fiction, clap. If you think that 60,000 pounds of shrimp every day is the fiction, clap. If you think that the atomic testing as a tourist attraction is the fiction, clap.
Oh,
all right.
Wow.
I think one and two are close, less on number three.
One and two are dead even in my opinion.
Yeah, all right. Rachie, what do you think?
I am suspicious of the numbers that you've put in number two. I mean, it sounds plausible, but I reckon you fiddled with the numbers there. So I
like
know.
To fiddle with things.
Yeah. I mean, you do things like that. You throw red herrings in, like, it's probably 40,000 pounds, not 60,000 pounds. So I don't know.
It's 59.
59.999.
He wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
There's an unwritten rule of order of magnitude if I'm just messing with the numbers.
Yeah, it'd have to be 6 or 600,000.
Yeah. I think number three is correct. I think it's science because and it's a very tenuous reason that I have is because I've been to the, like, nuclear museum around here. It's like a nuclear museum just up the road and you can go there.
Interesting.
And I do think that at one point blowing stuff up was promoted as a tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say that's science. I'm going to say that number two also is science, and I think number one is fiction.
The Nazi fiction. Okay,
number one is fiction.
Ah, gosh. That's Nazi plan to blow up the Hoover Dam narrowly. This sounds familiar to me, but I don't know if you've tweaked it in some way. Boy, did they get into the Hoover Dam? You know, they did have their spies. They did have their agents in the United States. That is shown. In fact, their boats taking pictures of our coastlines. But did they get all the way to the Hoover Dam? That's the question. And then shrimp. 60,000 pounds of shrimp every day, okay? More than the rest of the United States combined. This is the problem I'm having with this one. That number just doesn't seem to add up for me. Rest of the United States combined. I mean, places even like Alaska, I would imagine that would take. So I don't think I'm buying that one. And the atomic testing one, 65 miles north of Las Vegas. Yeah, I can believe that. I'm going to go with the shrimp as the fiction.
Okay, Jay?
I have no problem with the atomic testing one. Yeah, it just seems like if they could see it, that why not? Why not use that for marketing? 60,000 pounds, 600,000 pounds. I can't visualize any of it. All I know is I have seen shrimp a lot in the past 3 days. So, sure. Now, here's what I don't like about the World War II thing. First, why blow up the Hoover Dam? If they had agents that had bombs that could destroy something, why the Hoover Dam? Like, I mean, I'm not sure about how...
Power generation.
Yeah, but I understand what it does. But the point is, how bad would it have been for the infrastructure of this part of the United States to do it? Like, why not blow up a facility where they're building planes or whatever? So I just think that would be a waste of effort for a lot of reasons. And the other thing is, I am a fan of World War II, and just on the sheer fact that I've never heard about this is putting up a big red flag for me. So I think that's the fiction.
Tara?
I mean, when I first read all of them, the Nazi one is the one that stood out to me, but I always get myself in trouble because then I'm like, that means it must be science, and then I don't know. I think the atomic testing one could be science. It could be fiction, but it could be science. I definitely have images in my
definitely
mind. Yes.
Kara, it's your job to make a decision.
I know. I have images of my mind of the sort of 50s, 60s atomic era, like desert scapes.
Like Fallout 4.
It's exactly right, like Fallout 4.
Love it.
I'm thinking more like the Welcome to Las Vegas sign has that vibe to it. And it just, it reminds me a little of like Palm Springs or of like Nevada, or we are in Nevada. What do you call it? New Mexico. It has that kind of vibe to it. So I don't know. That one sticks out to me as though it could be science. 60,000 pounds of shrimp. What if it's like 6,000? Mm-hmm. That could be it. It could be just that it's 6,000. I do believe that it would be more than the rest of the U.S. combined. I'm assuming you mean, Steve, per day. More than the rest of the United States.
Each
a day.
The same.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yes.
That part of it, I would believe, absolutely. Like Alaska, like nobody lives in Alaska. Like there are people. It's a very low population state. You know what I mean? So I don't think that they, even though they shrimp or they catch a lot of shrimp, I don't think they eat a lot of shrimp comparatively. But the World War II, I'm like, there were Nazis hanging out in the U.S. I didn't even know that there were like Nazis trying to blow things up in the U.S. during World War II. I guess so. I don't, Steve, why do you do that? I've got to just make a decision. I'm going to go with, who went with number one? Rachie and Jay. Yeah, I'm going to go with Rachie and Jay.
Say the Nazis
is the fiction.
All right, Bob.
All right. I'll try to be a little quick here. The first one that really caught my mind was the atomic testing. 65 miles. I mean, I know it was in the 50s, but come on. I mean, that seems too close. I mean, it's beyond the horizon, but still, you get a nice little, some change in the weather that could blow some of that stuff down here. It seems very surprising. But then again, there is that museum that's kind of close. But I'm going to have to defer to the strategy of, like, I would have heard of it, and that's for World War II, the Hoover Dam one. And Jay, I do think that there is some interesting reasons why they would have done that. First off, it would have been demoralizing to think that they could have blown that up. I mean, that thing, that's a monument. I mean, the construction for that, the effort, if they blew that up, that would have been horrible.
Yeah, but I think that we would even have fought harder then, it would have had the adverse effect.
Well, and I also wonder, like, the cost to human life on that is relatively low. The cost of infrastructure side, but the cost of human life is low, and in my mind, that would actually be a consideration of the Nazis.
Yeah. Well, I'm still going to say that one is fiction.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll see how much you influence the crowd. If now, do you think that the Nazi plan to blow up the Hoover Dam is the fiction? Clap. 60,000 pounds of shrimp a day is fiction. Clap.
Oh, no.
Close.
And atomic tourism is the fiction. Clap.
Same.
Steve, I got a knock on the audience.
Evan's feeling really good about
it. I saw three people clap for two of them.
But
good odds there.
To my ears, it sounded like the audience is going against you guys.
It did, to me too.
They actually influenced them to disagree with you.
Yeah, backfire effect.
But on the no one on the panel thinks that the atomic bomb is the fiction, correct?
Right,
and
right.
Most of the audience doesn't think it's the fiction. So we'll start there. In the 1950s, atomic testing was conducted just 65 miles north of Las Vegas and was clearly visible from the casinos and promoted as a tourist attraction. I have a picture that will inform
No way.
There is the strip at the time. You can see the nugget. You can see the casino. That light in the background is not the sun. That is the initial flash of a nuclear explosion. And moments later, there is the mushroom cloud.
Wow.
That's scary as hell.
People We were so stupid.
Did you Photoshop?
Like, that wasn't even that long ago.
No, I was surprised. And yes, it was sold as a tourist attraction, and that's why, yes, there's a museum, and there was a Miss Atomic Bomb with like a mushroom cloud as a dress, you know. It totally has a Fallout 4 vibe.
Yeah, it does.
Totally. The culture of the video game is the 1950s.
Right, right.
Including this sort of, is it the atomic bomb is wonderful kind of, you know, vibe to it. Like, yeah. People were unconcerned
like
about
it. Very mid-century modern.
Yeah.
It was atomic bomb. Futuristic.
Yeah, it was awesome. Awesome. So
it's a scary freaking picture.
What's called? Yeah.
Right, look at that. There were multiple pictures that I found, but that's, there we go. Though. I love the flash, and then, wow. Gotta love it. Okay, so let's go to number one. During World War II, a Nazi plan to blow up the Hoover Dam was narrowly thwarted by an observant fisherman who reported the agent's suspicious activity. And everyone on the panel but Evan thinks that one is the fiction. Evan, you've had some solo wins recently. Maybe this will be another one. We'll see. I think that this was number two for the audience. The audience went more for number two, right? This is less than half of the audience think this one is the fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Oh! Now,
interesting story. So we built the Hoover Dam. It was a massive project. It was a massive obsession of American pride and our ingenuity Bob was absolutely right. There was a huge psychological component of the Hoover Dam. And it's not just power. It's also like water to the region, including Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And we actually uncovered, through our espionage, a Nazi plan to blow up the Hoover Dam. They were going to ride a tourist boat up to the dam, plant explosives, and blow it up.
Yeah. Huh.
But we got wind of it before they ever even got to the execution phase. And so we first of all, we banned any private boats anywhere near the dam. There's a pillbox where they put machine guns right above the dam. It's still there today.
Oh, wow.
They put the army on the dam. So they just basically completely beefed up security, and the plan never had a chance. So they never even attempted, because we just said, you're not gonna get in this way.
So even though there may have been an observant fisherman, he did not thwart anything.
He never got close. They never did anything. Our spies got the plan, and we put the security in place, and it never happened.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay.
That's so cool. All of that means that Las Vegas serves 60,000 pounds of shrimp every day, more than the rest of the United States combined, is science.
Wow.
I do have to put the slightest bit of an asterisk next to it. So every source says that, including government sources. I had reliable sources saying, yep, that's a fact.
Okay.
But couldn't find a primary source.
Interesting.
So I just have to say that, and it's plausible. A lot of people calculated how much that should be. People did the numbers, like, yeah, that's about right. If Las Vegas is eating this many pounds of shrimp a day, that kind of works out based on the tourist numbers. And yes, it's a lot of shrimp. Most of it comes from Asia. But they are building some local shrimp farms. I mean, it's just, you know, and shrimp in general, American consumption of shrimp is on the rise. It's a good source of protein. And again, micro farming, farming small things is a very efficient way to use our resources. So shrimp is on the rise. So that's true as far as I could tell. And if anyone could find a primary source that says it's not true, I'll happily, take that
back. I'll find it.
Yeah. Seriously, I spent a long time eating Snopes was like, we couldn't find an answer to it. But good luck. If you can find a primary source. But again, I figured a government source was good enough to at least have it be part of science fiction with the asterisk.
So if it's good enough for you, Steve, fine.
Yeah, okay. I'm just saying. Full disclosure, full transparency, okay? But I needed a cool item for science fiction in Las Vegas. Okay. Evan, you are going to finish us up with a quick quote.
I believe that a person should take an affirmative outlook. There are always problems in life, old and new, uncertainties and unexpected contingencies. The optimal way to deal with this is not to give up in despair, but to move ahead using the best intelligence and resources that we have to overcome adversity. Paul Kurtz.
Very nice. Thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome.
Thanks to CSI. Thanks to all of you in the audience for joining us. It was a pleasure. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. Thank you.